Well, coming up on today's show, it was a day of mad dog exchanges across the water. The rocket man shot off at the mouth and the president barked back. Our eye on this radioactive war of words will bring us the latest from Washington. Also ahead, the tax loophole tightening is facing ever-widening pushback as provincial premiers add their opposition to the finance minister's proposals. Manitoba's premier explains his objections. And we have the final segment in our series of feature interviews with the NDP leadership contenders. The rock and roller of the Fab Four is here. But first, North Korea's president took to the air today to denounce the President Trump as deranged amid warnings he was prepared to detonate a hydrogen bomb over the ocean. President Donald Trump tweeted back his answer. He said Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is obviously a madman who doesn't mind starving or killing his people, will be tested like never before. The Secretary of State Rex Tillerson waded into the growing Pan-Pacific crisis.
There will be assembled, and there is assembled on a standing basis, a National Security Council that meets on each of these issues to advise the president. Ultimately, it will be his decision.
Wow, calmly watching all this from his prime viewing spot in Washington is the CTV's Richard Madden. Richard, I mean, this drags diplomacy into a whole new gutter. What's been the follow-up this afternoon? Is anyone reacting to this war of words?
Yeah, there's been plenty of reaction from many experts, former diplomats who have dealt with the rogue regime. Many are suggesting, and one told me just a few hours ago, that President Trump elevating and giving so much attention to Kim Jong-un is actually damaging any chance for a diplomatic solution. And in fact, it further inflames tensions. There are reports already that Pyongyang is several propaganda posters are on the streets, are anti-American propaganda posters, and it's a way for Kim Jong-un to justify to his people the need to stockpile his nuclear arsenal by pointing to the president of the United States saying, look, this guy's threatening to wipe us off the map. We need to do this, likely proving to be more popular back home.
I'm curious. I mean, you know, war of words is fine as long as it doesn't go more than that. But, you know, it seems to me that the more you raise the tensions on these things, the more you close off exit ramps to diplomatic solutions. Are a lot of people saying that, you know, the box is getting smaller on this thing in terms of looking for a way out?
Yeah, well, for a lot of people, their suspicion is that the diplomatic window is closing the more these two continue to escalate this war of words. However, you just played a clip of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson a moment ago. He has been channeling that there is still a need for these two countries to sit down and speak and chat and communicate and find a diplomatic solution. But on the other hand, Trump may have boxed himself even more when he was at the UN the other day suggesting that the United States will back away from the Iran nuclear deal. So that doesn't give much incentive for the North Koreans to come to the negotiating table as well. So, you know, this might have to reach some sort of a boiling point of some war of words before these two eventually do sit down. But we are seeing sort of two message tracks coming from the administration. One, anger and tone coming from the president of the United States, which the world is starting to react and sort of figure out you don't really pay attention to his words, see what he does. And that's where the diplomatic side comes in. Rex Tillerson or James Mattis suggesting that perhaps there are ways to talk. However, underscoring all this, of course, is UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who is saying that nobody wants a war, but the United States is prepared to attack North Korea. So it's a tense time here, and you're dealing with two very unpredictable leaders.
I'd just like to get your thoughts on another issue. America, at least in terms of trade negotiations, moves north of the border to here on the weekend. Yeah. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, seems to be saying having some thoughts on this. Why don't you share them with us?
Yeah, so first of all, Don, I know you're very disappointed. I won't be in Ottawa for those NAFTA talks.
Oh, come on.
That'll be one of your columns. Yeah. But Wilbur Ross, he did do an op-ed in the Washington Post, basically arguing that NAFTA is killing jobs. And he really looked at the supply chain or the so-called rules of origin in the auto sector that not only doesn't help protect North American jobs, but a lot of the parts are coming from offshore. Obviously, this is, I'm reading this as a signal that the Americans are going to put that most controversial component of NAFTA on the agenda behind closed doors in these talks in Ottawa, and that has direct impact on the Canadian side of things. I can tell you, I was just at the last round in Mexico. That issue was supposed to be on the agenda, but they kicked that off because nobody could agree on anything, and they decided to move it up to the next round. And so this could be a very contentious moment when these three countries meet behind closed doors in the nation's capital.
All right.
And I won't be there.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Okay, darn it.
Okay.
We should come up next time. Okay. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the name-calling. This bitter name-calling between Donald Trump and North Korea has global implications. To share them with us, you can go through our social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or reach out via email. And the negotiators are starting to arrive in Ottawa to resume NAFTA's renegotiation sessions, with their political masters arriving next Tuesday. Today, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister hosted a blitz of advisors on the talks to try and nail down negotiating positions. Former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and former Conservative leader Ronna Ambrose were among those who joined the discussion. Also in the center of all the talks was Minister of Economic Development Navdeep Bains, and he joins us from Toronto. Minister Bains, the U.S. Commerce Secretary, made some interesting comments today. He suggests he wants more than the 62% North American content in cars. That would be to qualify for them being tariff-free. And he also seems to want American-made content to get a special bump. Your thoughts?
Well, right now, the current level is 62.5%. We recognize this is an important issue for the U.S., but it's also important for Canada as well. We have a strong supplier base here in Canada, over 700 suppliers. So we want to make sure we have a meaningful conversation to maintain that integrated supply chain that allows our suppliers to be globally competitive.
So what do you think, should there be one partner of the three countries in this free trade deal getting special treatment when it comes to content?
I think what we need to recognize is that when NAFTA came into force, it benefited all three jurisdictions. Our economies have more than doubled in the last 23 years. We've gone from $8 trillion economy to over $21 trillion. And the reason for that is we're more competitive together when we build things together. So the objective of these negotiations is to maintain that strong integrated footprint with respect to automotive suppliers and vehicles as well. And that's how we're taking on the negotiations.
All right, I guess the bottom line here is, are you convinced you can protect the auto jobs we have now during this NAFTA renegotiation?
Yeah, I think it's protecting the automotive sector, which is important. And these are a lot of jobs done. If you look at both direct and indirect, these are close to 500,000 jobs in Canada alone. And so that is our number one objective. How do we maintain and strengthen our automotive footprint, not only in Canada, but within the North American context as well? And we have to acknowledge the fact that we have to work with the U.S. and Mexico in order to do that. And I'm confident that we can do that.
One thing that's on your file is the verdict on this Boeing complaint against Bombardier over unfair trade subsidies. That comes down Monday, just as the political figures start talking about NAFTA's renegotiation. Is that like setting off a stink bomb at a wedding?
It's not an ideal situation, Don. You're absolutely right. We don't support the position taken by Boeing. It's completely unfounded. We've been very clear about our support for the Canadian aerospace sector. We've been very clear about the commitments that we've made for the jobs in the aerospace sector in research and development are consistent with our international obligations. And so that doesn't necessarily help the situation, but we again are working towards a resolution with Boeing. We've been very clear, we're engaged with them. But for us, the priority is making sure that we have strong aerospace sector jobs in Canada.
Well, it's seen as very unlikely that the U.S. Commerce Department will rule against or rule in favor of Bombardier on this and against Boeing. What's the next step after that happens?
So again, I mean, it's hypothetical. We don't know exactly what the preliminary determination will be on September the 25th, but we are prepared for all options. We've been looking at all conceivable options, both with the interim fighter jet solution that we're currently working with respects to Boeing, but also looking at how we can work with Bombardier to secure those jobs and those C-Series sales in the U.S.
All right, so you're pretty optimistic about this as it starts up in earnest on the weekend?
I think overall we're very optimistic. It's a great opportunity to modernize the free trade agreement. We want a progressive free trade agreement. And I think we've demonstrated that we're open to trade. We just celebrated the official, you know, CETA free trade agreement coming into force with Europe. So this is an exciting time for Canada as we continue to grow the economy. We have two amazing opportunities, both within the North American context and with Europe as well.
So NAFTA is too big to fail in your view?
NAFTA is way too important, and we're confident that we're going to get a modern, progressive deal that's good for Canadians.
All right, Navdeep Bains, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, a premier protest against the tax changes. Please stay with us. Okay, protests against federal tax changes for incorporated individuals has gone beyond angry doctors, small business owners, and family farmers. Today, premiers join the opposition. One of them leading the charge is Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister, and he joins us from Winnipeg. Premier, what are your business people telling you about these changes?
Well, Don, they're concerned, naturally, but I'm concerned, too. I'm concerned because Our principal job creators in our country are small and medium-sized enterprises. That's where 80% of our new jobs are going to come from in the next decade, and we need to make sure that we don't do something to jeopardize that. We all are in this together, and I think the general reaction from a lot of small business people is that they're being vilified by the federal government, and they don't appreciate that. You know, the use of the word loophole to describe what are mostly 40-year-old tax practices is really kind of divisive and I think offensive to a lot of small business people who are our friends and neighbors, right, and who we depend upon to create jobs for our kids.
Would you like the federal government just to cancel it altogether, or do you think it just can be tweaked and take aim specifically at people that might be abusing what is a tax advantage for others?
Well, I think there's a lot of receptivity to making sure that abuse is weeded out. It's one of the things that I fought for in my days in Ottawa, the use of offshore tax havens, things like this. These are the big ticket items that need to be pursued. But at the same time, the federal government's language has kind of tarnished the debate a little bit, more than a little bit in many quarters. And I think that that has been a problem thus far for the federal government to use words like 1% when we know this is impacting on, frankly, on thousands of small businesses that are making 50, 75 grand a year. Is not appropriate. This isn't about class warfare. These are the same businesses that sponsor our kids' hockey teams and the same professionals that, you know, donate to our charitable causes and so on. The family farm like I grew up on, where my mother worked off farm to support the farm many years. That farm wasn't very successful, but we were fed by my mother. Why not let a family like that, that builds a business together, split income? These are things that the federal government is having trouble explaining in terms of how they will work, and I don't think they've done the necessary work of determining what the impact would be on Canada's economy going forward of these proposals.
I think that's the concern a lot of people are having. There's an information void, and as you pointed out, a communications failure. You know, do you think this is something you're going to be raising at the first minister's meeting in October?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a concern, I think, to all Canadians. You know, this is the best definition, Don, that I've ever heard of a job is three words: capital at risk. And we need people that are willing to be entrepreneurs, to take risks, to put money to work and put it on a dream. And if they do that and they win, we all win because the jobs they create are jobs for Canadians. We're not all the same. Some of us are employees. Some of us are employers. Employers give up a lot. They give up a lot of security. In return, they take risks. And they deserve to be respected for that. They don't have the kinds of pension benefits, spousal benefits. You know, they get to work half days, granted, but and they get to pick which 12 hours a day they work, too. But the fact of the matter is, small business people, in my experience, are some of the hardest working people that you will ever meet. And so they need to be respected for the job they do, not only for themselves and their families, but for all of us in this country. This is where our future lies. And I'm also, as a premier, I'm very concerned when I realize the impact of this will be that you will see hundreds of millions of dollars taken away from our local economy, right, and it'll be given to Ottawa. Now, that does not mean a better economy for Manitoba. And if I have a chance to choose between those who actually create the jobs and those who just tax the people who create the jobs, I'm going to go with those who create the jobs every single time.
Bottom line on this, you see this impacting middle-class business people. This is not just a tax, that the wealthy are going to lose. You're convinced this extends to the middle class as well?
Absolutely, Don. Some of these tax measures were developed by the senior Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau, over 40 years ago. And these are methods or tools that are used by small businesses when they incorporate to structure their affairs to, of course, to minimize tax, but to defer income so that they're not up against it when there's a rainy day or a bad year, so they can save money, so they can reinvest in their business. I grew up, as you know, Don, a small farm. It's a little bigger now, and it's bigger in part because we didn't need Ottawa eroding our income to the degree that they're proposing to do now every single year. And we were able to save money. We didn't have to go to Bay Street and borrow, well, we did, but we didn't have to borrow as much because we had been able to save on a couple of good years.
Right.
This is how businesses work, and this is how our economy has worked for a long, long time. These are, frankly, far-reaching and relatively significant changes for what I consider to be the engine of growth of the Canadian economy, and I think it's appropriate the federal government take a sober second look at this before they proceed the way they've been proposing to do.
Brian Palliser, always a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure. Have a good weekend.
Coming up, an elder statesman of the NDP explains why he wants to lead the party. Please stay with us. Bit of Stomp and Tom performed by Charlie Angus. He's done it all, punk rock, protest, folk, and now it's all about this five-term MP winning the NDP leadership in less than 10 days. In the final of our four interviews with the hopefuls, Charlie Angus joins us in the studio. Horseshoe Tavern.
Horseshoe Tavern, at the one-year anniversary of Stomp and Tom's death, I was asked to get up and sing. So, I played the Horseshoe many times over the years.
That looks like a lot more fun than running for a leadership. Why on earth do you want to do this?
Well, I decided if I was going to run for leader, I was actually going to have fun doing it. And I've done music as well. But, you know, Don, there's a real disconnect out there. When I talk to Canadians, they don't buy the bubble they hear here. And I think for the New Democratic Party, like, what role are we offering in 2017? When I'm talking to, I'll give you an example. When I was thinking of running, a man stopped me in Timmins. He's 68 years old. He says, Charlie, I'm going back to work underground on the drills because my pension was robbed. There's something wrong in our country when that's happening. And what he said to me was fascinating. He said, I've been promised the moon by politicians. So just a simple thing, are you going to have my back? And that became, that stuck with me. People, you can promise people the world, but they just want to know, are you going to go in and fight for me? Are you going to stand up? Because these issues are affecting Canadians, people who thought they had pension security and don't have it. People who thought if they got $100,000 worth of student debt, they'd have steady work. Instead, they're, you know, perpetual short-term contract. These are issues that are out in the real world, and I feel in Ottawa, we're just not talking about it.
Well, one thing in the real world that you have been identified with quite closely. I mean, I met you with Shannon's Dream, a young girl who was killed by a drunk driver, wanted to get a school in her First Nation, and I think you were a catalyst to make that happen. I mean, what's your dream for First Nations? I mean, there's all this changing around ministries and talking to the UN about it. Is that making any difference?
Well, Don, and just, it was actually an accident with a truck. There was no drink, just in case the family's watching.
Oh, okay.
But I think Canadians look to our prime minister for the promise he made that we were going to deal with this. This is the issue of our time. The fact that we're losing children every single day, dying, giving up hope, but kids are killing themselves at 10 and 13. Canadians can do better. The problem is that the prime minister is talking the talk, but right now his government is in federal court trying to quash an order to make them accountable for children. And I'm sorry, that's just not on. How can we be allowing that to happen when we've seen the repeated failures to Indigenous children? We can do better. The commitments to build schools, every kid should have that. The suicide crisis, this endless cycle of you know, how many kids does it take to die before the government tweets and announces that they're going to send in an emergency team, and as soon as the media stop paying attention, it all goes back to the way it was? That has to change. And for me, that is a fundamental thing that can be changed.
How would you as leader do that? How do you use that? And you've got to get him back in power. Yeah. You got to be empowered. Yeah. How do you make that happen?
Well, we've got to dismantle Indian Affairs. That is an institution where billions go in. Nobody has a clue how it's handled. All these communities are stuck in these short-term cycles of having to apply to Gatineau. Kids fall through the cracks all the time. I would have an ombudsman for children that had order-making powers to make sure that these kids get what they need. Mm-hmm. Once we have a sense of how the department operates, I think a full independent audit, how do we start to devolve this so that we start to move it closer to the ground with an Indigenous ombudsman, but also with, you know, with the checks and balances? You couldn't do a worse job than what Indian Affairs has done and continues to do. And they will continue for the next 100 years. I don't care how many ministers you put there. You can put 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Unless we change and start to make them accountable more to the people on the ground who are not getting services, things aren't going to change.
Are you sticking around if you don't make the leadership? Is that Charlie Angus going to stay and do this fight?
Well, Don, I came here to speak for people who are being left off the political and mm-hmm. economic map of this nation. I didn't come to Ottawa 13 years ago to do the champagne and shrimp cocktail circuits. You know me, it means zilch to me. I didn't come to sit in a big comfy chair. Right. I came to make change. That's why I'm running for leader. And I ain't planning on losing, Don.
Good.
So I just want to get that out there. I am planning on losing.
Have you
but
back.
I am here to serve people, right. And that's why I came.
We'll have you back for the victory. All right. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks
appreciate
so much.
Coming in. Coming up, my last word on how Stephen Harper's political children are taking over Canada. Please stay with us. Now it's time for my last word. Well, here's some interesting political trivia. No provincial premier has ever become Prime Minister of Canada. That's what makes the phenomenon of Stephen Harper's political children so bizarre. While even the best premiers have declined or failed in a bid to move up the political pyramid to 24 Sussex Drive, federal conservative backbenchers are lining up to become premiers. Reports have it that MP Diane Watts will announce her entry into the BC leadership race this weekend. Insiders say her candidacy launches in front-runner position to challenge a potentially unstable NDP Green Party alliance, giving her a shot at returning to power within 2 years. And she would, if ultimately successful in capturing the leadership, become the fifth Harper-era MP to win or be placed in serious contention to become the premier in their home province. What's even more incredible is that 4 of these 5 MPs barely registered a pulse in the House of Commons before seeking provincial leadership roles. Patrick Brown was a silent television backdrop on the Harper backbench, and now he's the odds-on favorite to oust Kathleen Wynne from the Ontario premier's job. Brian Pallister is now the Premier of Manitoba after years of roaming Ottawa as an MP, where his main claim to visibility was his 6'8" height. Low-impact MP Brian Jean, who only stood out in the Harper caucus lineup because of his red hair, is duking it out with former Cabinet Minister Jason Kenney for the reunited Alberta Conservative opposition title. If the polls are right, the winner of that epic tussle will cakewalk back to power over an unpopular NDP government in 2019. So the possibility, if not the probability, exists that every province west of Quebec, except for Saskatchewan, could soon be led by an MP who served under Harper or ran under the Harper flag. That's 65% of Canada's population under Harper-nurtured politicians. One can only imagine how cranky First Minister's summits of the future will become if a re-elected Liberal government faces that sort of hard-right opposition from the provinces. Look, that's not to say that those who were incubated under Harper control will grow up to govern that way, but if nothing else, it puts to rest former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau's infamous derision of backbench MPs as nobodies 10 steps off Parliament Hill. Get them on home turf, and those nobodies clearly have the skills to become very powerful somebodies. That's the last word. And that's the show for today. Mirella Fernandez is standing by with the latest news headlines. As always, thanks to my producers for getting the show ready to air, to the crews here in Toronto for keeping us on the air, especially to you for watching. We return Monday, same time, same channel, very different power plays. Thanks for watching.